From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hysteria is starting to spread. That's what the mayor of Manatí on the north shore of Puerto Rico told the Associated Press. The hospital is about to collapse, he said. It's at capacity. According to Military Times, the Pentagon reports that only 21 of the island's 69 hospitals have even some functionality. 42% of the island has no drinking water. Federal aid increased yesterday after a Twitter storm of protests that the Trump administration wasn't doing enough to help the 3.5 million Americans on the island. Singer Mark Anthony tweeted to President Trump, "Stop talking about the NFL and pay attention." Today, he announced a humanitarian initiative. The rapper Pitbull sent his private jet to evacuate patients from failed hospitals. Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban did the same thing. NPR's Camila Domonoske is in Puerto Rico. She traveled inland to see some parts of the island worst hit by the storm. She's back in San Juan now and grateful. She has a working cell phone. Camila, what did you see?
Yesterday, we drove up into the mountains of Puerto Rico, south of San Juan, to some communities that really haven't seen any aid reach them. We talked to people whose houses were situated in exposed sections on top of mountain ridges where the storm's eye passed right over them and completely destroyed some houses, devastated others, ripped off sheds, tore off roofs, swept through the houses, destroyed furniture. People don't have access to running water. They obviously don't have electricity. It's often difficult to move around and get to other parts of the island. And again, people there are saying that they haven't seen people come through to help them. These are relatively isolated communities.
Well, some reporters are being greeted with the words, "Are you FEMA?" We know that FEMA is on the island, but what are some of the concerns that people are expressing? We've heard about water, people drinking from streams that might be contaminated. What are some of the other concerns?
Yeah, people are lining up to get water from mountain springs or get non-potable water that's been sitting in cisterns for days and days. People are going to rivers to do their laundry, to take baths, and expressing concerns over how they're going to get water to drink. Food is another major concern. Shipping is difficult over the island. It's hard to get food in. Some restaurants are staying open with the resources that they have. People are also sharing what they're finding after the storm. I talked to people whose neighbors were going through where their plantain trees used to be before the storm knocked them all down, finding what's there on the ground and then sharing it with the people in their community.
Yeah, we understand 80% of the agriculture on the island was just wiped out, 80% of the electrical system, and 100% of the distribution. This is according to the Pentagon, what you're talking about. There's no distribution system because there's no roads. Everything's cut off.
There's no diesel. There's no fuel. There's a shortage of drivers. People can't get to work.
Yeah. Look, we're seeing images here of reporters finding people, you know, waiting in their homes, insulin dependent, but their insulin is now sitting in water that used to be ice, which was keeping it. Here we're hearing reports of operating rooms slick with condensation on the floors because of the lack of air conditioning. You know, what is the sense of the health of the people?
Medicine and health issues are absolutely a major concern. That's something that local mayors are continuing to emphasize when they talk about the resources that their communities need. And, you know, the United States is sending a Navy hospital ship, but it won't be here for days, maybe more than a week. And meanwhile, hospitals, medical facilities that are running off generators have to find fuel for those generators. That's incredibly difficult. There's just a shortage of resources affecting the medical system across the board.
And they don't have schools. I mean, what are you observing about kids?
I talked to a 13-year-old yesterday who was at the river where he was taking a bath and hanging out with a schoolmate, and you know, he's saying there's no school, there's not going to be school for a long time, that there's not much to do at his house, that it's hard having to ration water and ration gas for the generator. And he said that he hadn't seen any aid to his family and that he wasn't expecting any. There was an incredible sense of, it's not quite despair and it's not quite resignation, but people are bracing for this to be very bad for a very long time.
Camila, do you think there is going to be what the governor said there might be, which is just an emptying of the island, these Americans coming to the mainland?
That's a good question. I've talked to several people who say, you know, I'm staying, I'm not leaving, I'm going to be here. But that's after 1 week of this incredibly difficult living situation. Some people are definitely getting out. Some people are, the lines at the airport, you know, are out the building. People are trying to get on the limited number of flights out. It's an open question how long some of these communities will be able to continue with the extent of the infrastructure damage.
And we're also reminded hurricane season isn't over.
Yeah, I mean, this was two right in a row.
And if there, you can't imagine if there's another. Camila Domonoske, NPR's reporter there in Puerto Rico. Camila, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, there's a deadline coming up in the next few weeks that could force President Trump's hand on the Iran nuclear deal. The White House has until October 15th to certify to Congress that Iran is complying with the terms of the deal. But the president has indicated that he may want to scrap the deal altogether. He said this in his speech to the UN General Assembly last week.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it. Believe me.
Joining us now is Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. She's in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And when you hear President Trump there and some of the other comments that he's made, it does sound like he wants to pull the U.S. out of this deal. Do you think that he will?
That's the question everybody is asking in Washington. He's certainly creating a great deal of suspense, as we know he likes to do. It is still our hope that he can be convinced not to do that and that there are other ways of achieving his goals of affecting other Iranian policies that he does not like.
Why is that your hope? What would the consequences of pulling out be?
I think the consequences would be devastating for the United States, for nonproliferation, for the region. This agreement prevents Iran from developing nuclear weapons for at least a decade and perhaps longer. It puts verifiable curbs on Iran's program. If the United States walks out, Iran has a couple of options. I mean, it can decide to continue to abide by the deal if others do, in which case the United States will be all alone and isolated on the world stage. It can decide that it will begin to resume some of the nuclear activities that were banned by the agreement, in which case we could possibly have the worst of both worlds where Iran is free to resume its nuclear activities and there is really no way the United States can get anyone to sit down and negotiate again.
Well, one of the things that the president, Trump, has complained about in this deal is that other issues are not part of the deal, including Iranian support for terrorism and testing of ballistic missiles. Should those issues be part of this deal? Could they be renegotiated into this deal?
No, absolutely not. The only reason this deal was achieved, and mind you, it really took over a decade of negotiations of various sorts to get here. The only reason it was achieved is because those other issues were put to one side. Now, the president, if he wants to talk about these other issues, and I've written an op-ed with Amir Hanjani, a senior fellow at my center, about this. If he wants to talk about these other issues, he should propose new negotiations. He should work out a strategy with our European allies and see if there are some inducements that can be presented to Iran to sit down and talk about these other issues. But if he walks away from the nuclear deal, we have the worst of all possible worlds. We have no constraints on Iran's nuclear program and no possibility of negotiating anything else.
How do you think the situation in North Korea is playing into the administration's thinking on the Iran nuclear deal?
I don't see much evidence that it is playing into the administration's thinking. I wish it were. You know, I think that the people at the State Department, Defense Department, at the CIA understand the linkages here. But the president doesn't seem to see it. You know, if the United States walks away from the Iran deal and Iran has not violated it, then what possible incentive is there for North Korea to reach any kind of diplomatic solution on its much more advanced nuclear program? You know, I think this is something really important. And it's not just North Korea. I mean, any international agreement, the president wants to renegotiate trade deals, all kinds of deals which he thinks are not fair to the United States. What country will sit and negotiate with the United States when it says, well, I've decided I don't like this agreement, even though you're abiding by it, so I'm going to walk away.
If the U.S. does walk away and the deal collapses, how long do you think until Iran has a nuclear weapon?
Well, the Iranians have made it very clear that they're going to do a cost-benefit analysis. If the U.S. walks away, they will see if the rest of the world stays within the deal, whether businesses, particularly big European businesses, will do business with Iran. If they are benefiting in this way, Iran will stay within the deal. If, however, the United States' action intimidates other countries to also walk away, then Iran will probably begin to test the margins of the agreement, perhaps have a little bit more enriched uranium or a higher level of enriched uranium than is otherwise allowed by the agreement, and kind of wait and see whether the world will react. I think another factor is that if this deal starts to fall apart because of U.S. action, it will be impossible to restore the kind of crippling sanctions that we had in 2012, 2013 that brought Iran to the table. And so it's delusional to think that we can somehow renegotiate a better nuclear deal if we walk away from this one.
That's Barbara Slavin, who is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
President Trump is turning his attention to tax cuts today after the news yesterday that the latest Republican effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act will not get a vote in the Senate, although the president said today that he wants a vote on health care early next year.
This was in a pop-up press conference on the White House lawn as the president left for Indianapolis for the tax cut rollout. Meanwhile, last night in Alabama, conservative firebrand Roy Moore won a runoff election, defeating Luther Strange, the establishment candidate backed by Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. A Washington Post headline screams, GOP anti-establishment wing declares all-out war. And President Trump, or someone, deleted his tweets of support for Strange. Okay, lots going on. Let's bring in Paris Denard, a Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. And Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. And Paris, your party in office, you start. It seems like a rough week so far for the president. His candidate loses, his health care plan loses, but then we have the president saying, no, I'm going to go back to health care. Your thoughts on the week?
You know, I think it's how you look at it. I think that the president has had actually a very good week if you look at the things that that are not being reported on, things like the important computer science initiative that Ivanka Trump is heading up that is a collective agreement with a private sector in Silicon Valley.
What about the things that are being reported on, though, like we just mentioned?
Well, of course, we don't want to talk about the good things, but yeah, the things about Luther Strange losing the primary. Look, at the end of the day, there is a large group of people who support Roy Moore, and that is a strong part of the base. And so at the end of the day, a strong Republican with a lot of support is going to be going up against a Democrat, and we hope that he can turn out the election. The president, the vice president, has already tweeted their support for him, as well as the RNC chair. When it comes to health care, the unfortunate thing about health care is you had a bunch of Democrats who decided not to work in a bipartisan fashion to get this to move something that could go through the House and the Senate and the president's
desk. Well, it was Republicans, though, that killed the health care bill right there.
It is a few Republicans who refused to do the right thing, but it was Democrats who also did not join in and do the right thing for the American people. Listen, you can decide to, they weren't invited, but you can decide to still vote for something, still come to and do the right thing for the American people when they're suffering. With these small Republicans that did not choose to support it, it's unfortunate when you look at Senator McCain, especially when the governor of the state of Arizona, where I'm from, and the other senator all came out in support of this because they know there are real ramifications for keeping Obamacare in place. So you have to start the conversation and do something. This bill, Graham Cassidy, could have passed the Senate, could have passed the House, and could have been signed by the president, but they didn't have the backbone of the will to do it.
Well, I guess it couldn't have. But yeah, Jamal, let me go to you. What do you think about this week for President Trump and for Mitch McConnell, by the way? This loss in Alabama was not good news for him either.
Republicans don't like to use the phrase Hastert rule anymore because of all the bad things that Denny Hastert did.
Yeah, remember Dennis Hastert, you know, the majority leader?
The former Speaker of the House,
yeah.
The former Speaker of the House who then got in trouble and got convicted of sex crime. So Denny Hastert's rule was that we're going to have a majority of the majority to pass anything. You need a majority of Republicans. If the Republicans would get rid of Denny Hastert's rule the way we got rid of Denny Hastert, the sex predator, we would be able to get things done in the United States Congress, but because you could build bipartisan coalitions from the beginning. You go through what John McCain asked for, which is regular order. Let's have some hearings, bring in some experts. Let's have our professionals put together plans. Let's have the CBO score it. Let's know how much it costs, and then we can make some decisions as adults. That's not the plan that the Republicans do, and I think that's something that we're going to have to fix if we're going to govern the country. And on this idea of Roy Moore, if you want to claim Roy Moore as a solid Republican, then if you feel free, but Roy Moore is somebody who doesn't seem to believe in the Constitution. He doesn't believe in separation of church and state. He doesn't believe that all Americans get a chance to participate in the country, and particularly he talks about people, browns and reds and yellows and things like that that he talks about. I mean, we should be looking for people who can come to Washington, who can make sure all Americans get a chance to succeed. And if Republicans want to invest their time and energy in somebody who doesn't believe that, then that will define the party.
Well, and to remind ourselves, Roy Moore, of course, had to leave the Supreme Court there in Alabama after he refused to remove the Ten Commandments statue. He also urged the other justices not to carry out same-sex marriages. Look,
he believes his Christian faith and his Christian law supersedes the American Constitution.
But Paris, I want to ask you, about this division in the party. Last night, former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon, who was very much for Moore, predicted a revolution would take down the Republican establishment.
And you're going to see in state after state after state, people that follow the model of Judge Moore, that do not need to raise money from the elites, from the crony capitalists, from the fat cats in Washington, D.C., New York City, Silicon Valley.
Paris, former conservative radio host Charlie Sykes says Republicans and Trump have unleashed something they can't control.
Well, look, we've seen this before. This is what we saw when it came down to the Tea Party and the Tea Party activism that happened. And a lot of people, Eric Cantor amongst them, were kicked out of office. There comes a time when people become frustrated within specific parties, and they decide to run candidates against establishment candidates. But look, the funny thing about all of this is that candidate Trump was exactly the type of candidate and led this revolution. And so it's expected to happen to the House and the Senate, because the American people and the Republican Party are saying that they want change and they want action. And when they see things like Obamacare not being able to get repealed and replaced, when they see people already talking that tax reform and putting more money in people's pockets is a bad thing, or when you see people on both sides of the aisles demonized for working with Republicans or working with Democrats to get things done, they want action, they want change. And so they'll bring in people that are willing to do that and stand up. And it doesn't take a whole lot of money. It doesn't have to take a lot of lobbyists and lawyers and PACs to do it. It takes the people coming out and voting. And that's a grassroots movement, which people underestimated. And that's how President Trump got elected.
The grassroots movement that Paris is talking about is one that advocates getting rid of people who are immigrants in the country. It's one that President Trump refused to say that people who were neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klan members were bad people. In fact, he called them many fine people. And it just elected a man in Arizona who doesn't believe in LGBT rights and doesn't believe that people from other backgrounds get a chance to participate. I think that's a different kind of civilization than the country that I want to live in. And we ought to have that debate the way it really is. Let's be really frank about it.
Let me ask you about Puerto Rico and the president's response to the crisis there following Hurricane Maria. People were calling for this ship, the USNS Comfort, to be sent to Puerto Rico to help. The president finally did do that, but it's going to take many days for it to get there. Jamal, what do you think of the president's response to the crisis in Puerto Rico?
It's lackluster so far, and I think both Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, which are both American territories, these are American citizens who are suffering. We're going to have to do more. Paris wanted to make sure a week or two ago that we gave the president credit with what he did in Texas. Let him have that credit, but that also means that he has to take the blame for the fact there are American citizens who aren't getting enough food or getting enough water or getting their power turned back on.
Yeah, and Paris, some would say that the reason that the president wasn't as involved with Puerto Rico was he got so involved in that NFL kneeling controversy. Now, on CNN last night, you had an exchange with Cornel West, which, by the way, I direct people to it. It was riveting. And Quite a conversation. But in it, you praised President Trump as a catalyst for conversation. And you have to ask, you know, Colin Kaepernick is out of the game. He's the original player who kneeled. Kneeling wasn't even a big issue. Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush and others cited people close to President Trump saying that it wasn't a catalyst for conversation. It was a calculated effort to shore up his base in Alabama because he wasn't supporting their favorite candidate, Roy Moore. Your thoughts on that? That this, you know, you talked about a grassroots movement, but this seems like throwing red meat to incite.
I also said in that riveting conversation that you called it that there's unintended consequences. And I think one of the unintended consequences of the president's statement in Alabama at the rally for Luther Strange was that it did create a conversation, a national conversation about patriotism, about respect, about civility, about respect, things that we weren't having based upon what Colin Kaepernick did a year ago. Because when you look at it, Colin Kaepernick took a knee. And it was controversial at the time, but you didn't see this groundswell of support for him or the things that he was standing up for. And the idea, in my opinion, that the president was off the message or not focused on Puerto Rico is absurd, because the president said last week he was going to Puerto Rico in the Virgin Islands, wasn't able to get there because the airports are messed up. And since then, over 10,000 federal responders are already on the ground. Last 24 hours, we've had over 200 gas stations and diesel fuel that are getting pumped and getting fuel over there. And you've had thousands of workers there. I mean, the 1.1 million pounds of food and over 1 million liters of water are there. The government is working. The governor of Puerto Rico has said he praised the FEMA and he's praised the president's response on it. So just because the president isn't tweeting as much as people would like him to be tweeting about it, doesn't mean the government, FEMA, and all of the other organizations are not doing everything that they can to support our brothers and sisters in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Jamal, we've just got about 30 seconds left, but let's come back to where we started, which is what's happening today and this conversation about tax cuts. Where are the Democrats going to stand on that? Are they going to stand against every idea of a tax cut or not?
Look, I think we'd all love to get tax cuts. Who doesn't like to have candy? The question is not whether or not we'll have tax cuts. The question is, I think Democrats will ask, is what is our strategy for growth? And are we growing the economy or are we growing the debt and growing inequality? And I think that's the question we're going to have.
Are we growing the middle class? Yeah. Without tax cuts, you can't grow it.
Well, and it might be fiscally conservative Republicans who are against the cuts and the deficit that it will increase. We got to cut it there. Paris Denard, Republican strategist, Jamal Simmons, our Democratic strategist, taking a look at the week so far. It's only Wednesday. Thank you both.
Take care.
Drug companies spend billions every year on television and magazine ads targeted at specific demographics. That's why if you watch one cable station, you think everyone has fallen down and can't get up. And on another station, everyone is miraculously able to show their bare arms after curing psoriasis. But now these companies are going a step further and targeting specific patients with ads on the internet and on smartphone apps. But wait, how can you do that without violating privacy laws around medications? Rebecca Robbins is the business reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. She joins us now. Rebecca, how do they get the data and how do the companies get around these privacy laws?
These data come from a variety of different sources. So there's things like census data, survey results that help inform the targeting. Then there's patterns that are deduced from analyzing these huge quantities of anonymized health records.
So they're anonymous.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So these are things like electronic health records recording a doctor's visit, insurance claims, pharmacy transactions. So this information is stripped of patient names, so your name would not be attached to this information. But these marketers are using this trove of information in order to deduce patterns about who are the most likely people to want or need a particular drug. It was pretty fascinating to report out. There's a lot of technology and tools that I think people don't understand day to day. I certainly didn't until I did this story.
Hmm. And STAT also looked at how drug companies are reaching out to patients to get them to sign up for clinical trials or to connect with financial assistance programs. We know that this is happening after the hurricanes in Texas and Florida. You've written about that. How does that work? Same way?
Yeah. So again, we're seeing these targeted ads that are aimed at people maybe based on where they're located or which pages on Facebook they like. So again, this more precise targeting, which is a really different approach from the traditional model, which is trying to reach these broad demographics who might read Time magazine or watch Good Morning America.
So again, it's not as if some doctor or some pharmacist is handing over your name and your medical issue so that a drug company can target you with an ad on your cell phone. But still, it might be alarming for people to have an ad show up. You know, how did you know that I had that disorder and needed that medication? But are the drug sellers, you know, is it working for them?
I think, as you alluded to, you know, everyone's had that familiar experience in online shopping where, you know, you looked up some dress pants and then suddenly everywhere you go, you're seeing these ads for dress pants. And I think with drug advertising, we're really moving towards that model. Some of the marketers that I spoke with said that they were seeing much higher rates of people actually exploring the drug website and taking steps towards getting a prescription from these strategies rather than the broad targeting that we've seen traditionally.
Yeah. Rebecca Robbins, business reporter with Stat. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Almost 100,000 people have evacuated on the island of Bali after warnings that its Mount Agung volcano may soon erupt. Officials issued a state of emergency and ordered everyone living within a 7.5-mile radius of the mountain to leave. Rosalie Lopez is a volcanologist and senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Rosalie, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
And what can you tell us about this volcano in Bali, Mount Agung?
Well, it's potentially a very dangerous volcano. It had an eruption in 1963 sent out pyroclastic flows. Now, pyroclastic flows are the nastiest thing that a volcano can put out. Lava flows, you can actually get away from them most of the time, but pyroclastic flows are hot currents of gas and ash. They are what killed a lot of people in Pompeii. And it's almost impossible to get away from them. They can move very fast. And in 1963, pyroclastic flows killed 1,500 people in Bali.
And researchers began their warnings days ago. We hear reports that some of the animals in the area, monkeys and snakes, have been acting strangely because they may think that an eruption is coming. How do you predict a volcanic eruption?
Well, there are a number of ways, but what they have been using mostly is monitoring the seismic activity. When magma starts coming up to the surface, obviously it starts fracturing things and moving the ground. And so you get an increase in the seismicity, so small earthquakes, which is probably what is causing the animals to act strange. There can be other indications as well, you know, different composition of gases and some inflation of the ground because magma is pushing up and so on. But from what I understand, the local volcanologists have used, you know, mostly the seismic monitoring to say that an eruption may happen very soon. Now, it's important to remember that sometimes, you know, a volcano gives some signs and an eruption doesn't happen or an eruption is not very large. But, you know, they want to play safe.
I remember several years ago, there was an eruption in Iceland and it caused all kinds of problems for air traffic. Planes could not fly in that cloud. Do you expect the same thing to happen with Bali?
It could happen. In fact, it's not that uncommon that you actually get explosive eruptions leading some aviation warnings, you know, and they can stop air traffic for, you know, a day or a few days. But the eruption in Iceland was somewhat unusual. It wasn't even a very large eruption, but it put out a lot of ash and the winds were in the right direction and it created quite a mess. But it wasn't even like a catastrophic eruption or anything like that.
And in the year 2017, with the warnings that we do have, shouldn't it be possible to have a volcanic eruption and no deaths if you get people out of the way?
Yes, if you get people out of the way, it can be difficult because a lot of people don't want to leave. And from what I've been reading about the local population, they're also concerned that their livestock is being left behind, and so they're taking turns going in and feeding livestock. And I gathered that some cows have been evacuated as well. But, you know, it's people's homes and often livelihoods. So it can be difficult to persuade them to get out.
Aside from the volcano in Bali, what are the other trouble spots that you watch around the world, of volcanoes that could erupt?
Well, actually, most people don't realize that every month you get between 20 and 30 volcanoes erupting somewhere in the world. They are not large eruptions because you hear about the large eruptions, but there is volcanic activity going on all the time. Kilauea in Hawaii, for example, mostly lava flow, so not any imminent danger because the explosive eruptions are the most dangerous. But, volcanic eruptions are part of the earth and they are actually quite common. Some volcanoes like Stromboli off the coast of Italy have been active for at least 2,000 years.
But would you say that in general, we are in a relatively peaceful period right now when it comes to volcanic eruptions?
In general, yes. Certainly in the early history of the Earth, we had much larger volcanic eruptions, such as in Yellowstone, for example. But the last really large catastrophic eruption in Yellowstone was about 640,000 years ago.
Right. And that is what's considered a super volcano, right? How do they differ in size and impact from a volcano like the one in Bali?
Well, Yellowstone is a different type of volcano. It's called a caldera. It's about 40 miles across, caused by a removal of magma in enormous eruptions. Yellowstone is kind of like a volcano on steroids. It could have very large eruptions. But having said that, there is a lot of evidence that the magma chamber has, largely cooled down and, there is no evidence that there is going to be another enormous eruption, anytime, soon or even in the future.
Are there other major volcanoes like that around the world? I mean, the one that comes to mind for me is the one that caused Santorini in Greece to be what it is today,
yes.
Right?
Yes, that's right. In around 1600 BC, that eruption was again, that was a super volcano, catastrophic eruption. And, those eruptions can actually affect the climate. They can cool the average climate of the Earth by half a degree Celsius or a degree Celsius. And one example that's more recent is the eruption of Tambora in Indonesia in 1815. Now, the year 1816 was considered the year without a summer. The climatic change was noticeable around the world. And the danger with eruptions that put out a lot of ash, as well as, this cooling of the climate, but locally they can destroy crops and lead to a famine.
So what can be done, or can anything be done, should anything be done to prepare for an eruption of a volcano or even a supervolcano?
Well, what has to be done is monitoring, very careful monitoring, so that you actually know when a volcano is likely to erupt. Volcanoes generally give a lot of warning before an eruption, so they don't just go bang in the night. So in a way, I'd much rather deal with volcanoes than earthquakes, because, you know, earthquakes don't give these right. Warning signs. And sometimes, you know, volcanoes give weeks of warning signs, or even longer.
What made you get into this line of work? Why did you want to become a volcanologist?
Well, I actually got a degree in astronomy, but I was studying planetary geology, and one day my professor didn't show up, and he sent a substitute, and the substitute said Mount Etna erupted, and the professor had to go. So I thought that was quite exciting, and by that time I was kind of tired of freezing, being very cold at astronomical observatories. So I decided to change line of work and go for something warmer.
And what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, I study mostly planetary volcanoes. I started out by studying volcanoes on Mars and then volcanoes on Jupiter's moon Io. And now I study more cryovolcanoes, which are volcanoes that, instead of erupting hot magma, they erupt water mixed with other things, you know, maybe, you know, ammonia, methane. And if that erupts, it is a volcanic eruption, although it's not a hot rock.
But we don't have any of those on Earth.
No, we don't.
That's Rosalie Lopez, who is a volcanologist and senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Rosalie, fascinating. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
On a high desert hilltop in northwestern Colorado, there's a large metal tower that over the years has become something of a sonic playground for musicians. It's called The Tank, and Brad Turner from Colorado Public Radio explains why the world is about to hear a lot more music played inside this 65-foot mountain of rusty steel.
It's just before sunset in Rangeley, Colorado. A small crowd gathers at a 60-foot-tall metal structure for a unique concert. The Grammy-winning vocal group Roomful of Teeth stands inside the tank and begins to sing. Only a few dozen spectators can squeeze into the tank with the singers. Most of the audience, including many families with children, listens from outside. There's a set of speakers spread across the surrounding hilltops. The voices and Roomful of Teeth and the sounds created by the tank's amazing acoustics bounce off the desert landscape. The music mixes with crickets down the hill.
If I whistle, it sounds like this.
This is why the tank is special. The smallest sound can reverberate and swirl around you for what seems like an eternity. Decades ago, the tank held water for a railroad in Colorado. But there's no railroad in Rangeley. The story goes that a power company moved the tank to town and rebuilt it on a hilltop more than 50 years ago. But it sat empty for years. Bruce Odland is a sound artist and composer. He's also board president of what's now called the Tank Center for Sonic Arts. His first time in the tank was four decades ago.
You're in the middle of your own sound field, and it comes back with such amazing feedback. The tank is a teacher. Everybody who comes here learns something about listening.
The tank is unique because it has a cone-shaped roof, a floor that bows up in the middle, and metal walls that trap the noises inside. That sound kept Odland coming back. Sometimes he stayed in the tank for 3 or 4 days and used portable recording equipment to make music like this. and he still loves introducing visitors like me to the tank. So I'm stepping in. The heat inside wallops you. The temperature rises above 100 degrees when the afternoon sun beats down.
And it's pretty dark in here.
And then Odlin shuts the door for better sound. Odlin steps toward two metal handles on the wall and smacks them with a mallet. Odlin and other supporters launched an online fundraiser in 2013 to preserve the tank, and another in 2016 to open it to the public and make it a recording studio and performance venue. About 1,400 donors chipped in more than $100,000 online to save the tank and upgrade it. Now the tank sits next to its own recording studio, and a group called Friends of the Tank owns the property. Those campaigns to save the tank also got thousands of people to watch tank performances online, and they caught the attention of Roomful of Teeth. This summer, Roomful of Teeth flew to Denver and drove 5 hours across the Rocky Mountains to record new music and to give a concert at the tank. The group's artistic director, Brad Wells, remembers the first rehearsal.
I keep thinking of the tank as a bit like another planet. The normal Earth laws of acoustics don't apply here.
The singers usually record in comfortable, dry-sounding studios. Wells says the tank is the opposite. A turn to the side or a step toward the wall can change your sound.
An acoustical playground, in a sense. Yeah.
Odlin and other tank supporters see the tank as more than a recording studio or a venue. They want it to be a sonic oasis, a place where students learn about sound and artists explore it when they step inside and listen.
And it hits everybody the same way, from a kid to a professional musician from New York. That's precious, a real honest-to-goodness sense of awe that my senses can do so much more. Sound means so much more than I thought.
Odlin says that's why supporters wanted to save the tank and share those sounds with the world. For Here and Now, I'm Brad Turner.
Ringing Chords. To see more of the tank and hear performances, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.